97.9 FM, WCHL, and chapelboro.com present The Art of Potential, an illuminating talk show dedicated to getting your community educated, hired, and inspired. The Art of Potential combines real-world knowledge and expertise aimed at helping our community reach their full potential. Now, The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Hi, this is Kristen Heemstra. Welcome to the Art of Potential show. Oh, is our show so very interesting today. We are going to be talking with Dr. Stacy Wood about consumptive behaviors. This impacts everybody. Welcome, Dr. Wood.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
All right. So believe it or not, you have most likely already heard of her or read her research. If you say read USA Today, she's been featured on the front page, or Time Magazine. She also had a big article in there. So Dr. Wood, can you please tell us why people are so interested in your research?
I think it's because we're all consumers. So there are a lot of academic fields that are, let's face it, only interesting to the people who study them. But this is a lovely field in that it's very important for the business world. It's very important for our marketplace, our economy. And yet it impacts us on a day-to-day basis as we're making decisions about how to spend our time, our money, all of our resources.
So we're basically, when we are looked at by, say, a corporate environment, we're just looked at purely from our consumptive behaviors. Would you say that's...
I think that companies pay a lot of attention to how people buy, but it's only recently that they've really become interested in sort of individual behavior and psychology. In the past, they looked at big segments of people. So were you a woman? Were you in a certain socioeconomic group? Were you of a certain demographic? But these days, we look at behavior at a much more individualistic level. And the cool thing about that is that we get to study very neat things like psychology and sociology and anthropology to understand how we make these decisions, because it's not a purely economic thing. It's not just a matter of weighing benefits and costs and making a logical decision. There's a lot of, I'll say, fuzziness in there.
Well, so one of your most recent projects, which is just fascinating to me, is when people are the most open to trying new things.
Yes. A lot of my research focuses on the psychology of innovation, how people adopt new products, new ways of doing things, new trends. I think I like this a lot because I myself am very bad at change. I'm a very habitually oriented person. So I find it just fascinating to study new products. And one of the things that I was looking at in this project was, when do people just intuitively, inherently embrace change and embrace new, exotic, unfamiliar options? And what I found was that it actually is a completely counterintuitive thing, that we seek out those new things at times when we're in a state of upheaval.
Okay, so explain this to me a little bit more. So if our lives get thrown into, intentionally or unintentionally, into some managed or unmanaged sense of chaos, that is when we are going to go to Target and buy the you know, leopard skin dress, or, you know.
It could be. You know, it's interesting because the intuitive sort of lay theory about states of upheaval, chaos, change, is that during those times, consumers tend to embrace comfort foods and the familiar.
Something to anchor them. Like, this I know is my anchor, so I will have hot chocolate every hour on the hour or whatever it is.
Yep. And there's a lot of research on comfort foods, and they do actually give comfort. So they are things that...
That's interesting. I actually didn't know that.
They oftentimes, comfort foods themselves tend to be high in fat content, high in carbohydrate content. There are biological reasons for those. But really, comfort foods can be anything that's familiar and gives you a sense of safety. You know, your mom's meatloaf. If you're from India, it might be your mom's chana masala. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be anything that's familiar. But what we tend to think is that when we are in a state of change, chaos, upheaval, that we'll embrace those things as a way to balance. But what I found is that it's actually exactly the opposite. Even though people predict one type of behavior, they do the opposite. When they're in a state of change, they actually are more likely to choose exotic, unfamiliar, brand new options.
All right. So how did you come to this conclusion? What are your data points?
That's right. This has to be empirical. Right. So this was one of my favorite studies of all time because it involved potato chips. I am a...
You got to love a job where you get to study potato chips and behavior around those.
I know. When you have some control about what you use as your stimuli, it's a good thing. So I love salty foods. And one of the things that I noticed in my travels is that here in the U.S., we have potato chips and there are certain flavors. You know, you can have plain, you can have barbecue, you can have sour cream
salt
and chives.
Salt and vinegar.
Salt and vinegar. But in the U.K. and in Britain, I fell in love with what they call potato crisps, which are potato chips, but they're in these really exotic flavors like camembert and plum and Thai chili pepper and just really interesting, unusual flavors for a U.S. consumer.
Yeah.
So I thought, here's a great thing to study. I'll look at how people make choices between these two kinds of varieties because they're basically the same product. We're holding the fat content and the calorie content similar. But we're only varying the sort of the exotic, unfamiliar aspects of these things. And so what I did was I first did a study where I wanted to see just what people predicted. So I told my subjects that there were two different consumers. One consumer was in a state of change. That person had a lot of stuff going on, had a lot of upheaval in their life, and they were offered this choice between either getting a free bag of a Lay's potato chips in a familiar flavor or a popular British brand in an unfamiliar flavor. And then there was another consumer who their life was very habitual right now. Nothing was really going on. And I said, what do you think each of these people will choose? And so what we found is that common with this Lay theory, people thought that the person whose life was very habitual and kind of bland right now would choose the exotic chips. And the person who was in a state of change would choose the familiar Lay's potato chips. And then in a second study, what I did was I actually asked people to tell me how much change was going on in their life. So I had them self-report their level of change. And then, I don't know, 45 minutes later, and what seemed like a totally unrelated choice, I said, oh, by the way, one thing you're going to get today is a choice between this familiar Lay's potato chip or one of these exotic flavors of British potato crisps. Which would you like? And what we found is that when we looked at people's choices, more choice of the exotic flavor was linked to people who were currently in a state of upheaval, change, or flux. We did a number of studies kind of manipulating different things to make sure there wasn't bias, so we did good, rigorous academic research. And then in the last study, we wanted to make sure that this wasn't you could think that this might be that the person who's in a lot of change just happens to be the kind of person who likes change.
Right.
And therefore would like
that,
those chips.
Yes. No, that makes sense. I didn't even think about that. Mm-hmm. But there are people who just have more change.
Yeah. We call them variety seekers. Yes. So there are those people. So instead of measuring people's inherent state of change, we manipulated it. So the way we did that was when we had people come in, we asked them to either list two big changes going on in their life right now or eight big changes going on in their life right now. And so we randomly assigned them to one of those two conditions. And interestingly enough, people did not have trouble thinking of either two big changes or eight big changes.
Oh, wow.
But the people who had listed eight big changes clearly were sort of, it was top of mind that there was a lot of change going on in their life. And later on, when we asked them about that chip choice, sure enough, the people for whom all the change in their life had been made salient were more likely to choose the British exotic, unfamiliar flavor of chip.
So a marketing company sees this research, and they see the fact that, okay, people are more likely to be open to change, and we have this product we really want people to try, and we know that they always buy product X, but so we only, it sounds like they have a really small window where they can, like, grab the customer and get their product in, and it has to be at a state when someone's open to change. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, that's a really good insight for companies, is that when do you hit consumers with your coupons and your promotions and your big signs in the store? It really can be for a time when people are going through a state of change. And the nice thing is that that might be counterintuitive to someone's Lay theory about, somebody who's in a state of change is not going to want to try our new detergent, our brand new soda flavor. That's not when they're going to want to do it. But actually, my research shows that that's a perfect time. Case in point, Target has recently found out that they really love to identify consumers who are expecting children. Mm-hmm. Because as we know, a child really changes your life.
And your spending habits.
Yes. And your habits in a lot of different things.
Yep.
And that what they found is that these consumers not only changed their consumption by adding in baby-related products, but actually changed their consumption across the whole store. And so identifying these consumers is really important. Now, my research fits in perfectly with that. It gives them a reason why. And it says, you know, during the state of change, our eyes are just opened to new options. It's like mm-hmm. the threads that normally sort of tie us into our habitual life have been cut. And since we're freed from those habits that put blinders on us, We're looking around going, well, I know I need diapers. I have no idea where diapers are. I'm looking around. Oh, but, you know, here are scented candles, which I've never bought.
Right.
But that looks interesting.
Here's some Febreze, which I certainly will be needing.
Exactly. So it's a very important insight for marketers that if you have a way to measure when people are going through a state of change, either a new address, a new change, status of family, marital status, people, you know, college graduates, recent high school graduates, anyone you know who's going through a state of change, those people are really open to trying new options. It's not a time to hit them up for the extremely mainstream market leader, thing that they might be buying all the time. But it's a time to really try different stuff.
Okay. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about, it sounds like we could even use this to create some change in our lives. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra with The Art of Potential Show, and I am talking with Dr. Stacy Wood. Stacy, or Dr. Wood, is the Langdon Distinguished Professor of Marketing at NC State, and her area of expertise is in behavioral marketing and consumption. So we just talked about change being one of the windows in which we're open to trying new products, correct?
That's correct.
So can we then use that change to manipulate our own behavior?
Absolutely. This is a really interesting finding because it helps not only marketers but also consumers to better understand themselves and to create positive change. So, for example, when I first moved to Chapel Hill, I had a lot going on, you know, move, shopping in new stores, setting up a new dentist, a new doctor, getting used to a new job, you know, all the things that go along with moving. Well, I wanted to start an exercise program, and my mother gave me the advice that perhaps I should wait till things had settled down, till I tried to start that exercise program. She said, "You have a lot on your plate. Just wait till you get into a little bit more of a groove."
Yeah.
And that actually, unfortunately, is bad advice, given my research. Sorry, Mom. Because what happens is that when we're in that state of flux, that's a great time to start new healthy habits. So if there's something that we really wanted to be doing, whether it's exercise, whether it's giving up a bad habit like smoking, a great time to do it is when we have a change, when everything else is completely different. Again, intuitively, we might feel like, oh, that's a bad time
right. Because
I'm stressed out.
Right, and that's my crutch, and I lean on that, and mm-hmm. Yes.
But again, one of the hardest things about breaking bad habits and starting new habits is breaking your habitual routine. So
yeah.
For smokers, if every time they step outside, it's to light a cigarette, it's hard to hit that stimulus and not respond
right.
in the habitual way. Now, if you have a new job where you're stepping out of a different door, suddenly that is uncoupled a little bit, and you
yeah.
have this time when you can more easily break that habit. Or if you have a time when you don't have sort of a habitual routine that you're trying to insert a healthy habit into, again, you're just not fighting against the habits of a static, well-ordered
right.
life.
Right. So going back to your example of trying to integrate an exercise program into your life, it sounds to me like if that's a goal that somebody had, the way to begin to create it would be to create some type of rift in the in the daily routine so that there's, I don't know, an opening, if you will, to insert something new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing would be to try and create a little chaos so that you're breaking up some of your old habits. But in a way, it's just taking opportunities for change. Like you said, we have a lot of change in our life that is not exactly planned or even sometimes desired, but those can actually be great opportunities to insert these new practices, these new trying unfamiliar, novel, exciting things. And that's the important message here, is that that's not a time when you should be trying to hunker down.
Right.
And do the same old thing.
Right. And establish, the habit part is interesting because it's kind of like what you're looking at are people's habits. We're all, and I think actually the research came out of Duke, is it 45% of our day is habitual? Is that?
That's probably pretty accurate.
Yeah. So we've got, and that's a large part of your day. Almost half your day you're just doing on route behaviors. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be some level in which you start to identify your habitual behaviors. Is that part of the, when you're looking at an equation, part of what you're looking at?
Well, in a way, habits drive so much of what we do, and so much of our consumption is implicit, meaning we don't think about it.
Right.
We don't think about it. We don't realize what is influencing our choices.
Right.
And that is one of the bedrocks of why consumer behavior as a field is growing by leaps and bounds, why companies are paying so much more attention to it, why consumers are paying so much more attention to it, because it's as if we've suddenly woken up to the fact that we are making wildly influential choices in our lives on a day-to-day basis in tiny little steps that we don't actually think about as much as we think we do think about, or that we should think about.
Unconsciously.
It is true. And this worries a lot of people. And one of my favorite things about teaching consumer behavior is that I'll have MBA students who are highly thoughtful, logical, intentional people.
Right.
Who will hear this, that a lot of our consumption decisions are impacted by attributes and decision points that we don't even process at an aware, explicit level. And they'll say, oh, I can see how other dumb consumers would do that. But for myself, clearly that doesn't happen.
I'm so smart. Yes. That would never happen to me.
Yes. And I consult for a lot of high innovation, high technology companies where you're dealing with engineers and brilliant bench scientists, and they are even worse. and so other people do this, but I myself do not. And so some of my favorite moments are where I'll have just little thought experiments or little things I do with people to show them that, yes, they too fall prey to these heuristics and traps of habitual or implicit unaware thinking that we use, really, not only in just choosing a pack of gum as we're standing in line at the grocery store, but how we choose our health care and how we choose, you know, just our houses and really big, impactful purchases.
Well, okay, so I want to know what one of these things is that you do to these people.
Well, I think one of my favorites revolves around the heuristic called the compromise effect. And the compromise effect is an implicit tendency for us to choose middle options.
Mm-hmm.
If we are offered an array of, say, three options, the middle option grabs us and pulls us in a way that we don't realize. And you might think that it's illogical, but it's actually based on sort of an intuitive sense of a normal distribution, right? Like we think of a bell curve, a normal distribution, and middle options are normal. Lots of people do them.
Yeah.
And extreme options are for weird people. You know,
the extreme sportsman.
Exactly. Right? So we kind of sense this, and we use this in a way that we don't realize. So I have my MBA students fill out an online survey before they even start the class. And I ask them just to make a couple of different consumption choices, just, you know, small little things. And one of them is to choose, I give them a scenario where they're going to a friend's house for dinner, and that friend calls up and says, oops, I forgot to buy artichoke hearts. Can you buy a jar of artichoke hearts on your way over here? You stop at the store. You don't know much about artichoke hearts. You're offered three different brands. You don't know these brands. and they're three different prices. So there's a higher price, a middle price, and a lower price. And I ask people to say, which one would you choose? And so they choose it. And then in class, I show them that the vast majority of the class chooses the middle option.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is because you look at these three options and you say, gosh, you know, I don't want to be cheap.
Right.
But no way I'm going to get ripped off and pay, you know, I think the expensive option is like $2.99. I'm not going to pay $2.99 for a jar of artichoke hearts. You know, you've never bought artichoke hearts in your life. And suddenly $2.99 sounds like ridiculous.
Because you have something to compare it to.
Right, exactly. And so everyone goes, oh, yes, we did. But then what I show them is that I only did that particular selection for half the class. The other half of the class saw an option that had four jars of artichoke hearts, where there was not only that quote-unquote expensive $2.99 jar,
right,
but a really expensive $4.99 jar.
Mm-hmm.
And I show how the market share or the choice in the, you know, among my participants goes up 20% for that expensive jar of artichoke hearts when it becomes the middle option.
Yeah. And as you're saying this, I can completely see myself in the grocery store thinking exactly like this.
Yeah, you've never bought artichoke hearts in your life, and then suddenly you're buying them. And if there's a $4.99 jar, well, then $2.99 sounds downright reasonable.
Yeah, it does. Suddenly it's a bargain.
So this is the funny thing is that we use this sort of rubric for everything we choose, like our healthcare options. I mean, you think about which plan do you buy? Do you buy the one that with all the bells and whistles that's really expensive? Do you buy the bare bones one? Or do you go, well, I think actually I feel more comfortable with this middle option B.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you know, if sometimes they do that bronze, silver, gold. You know, I like the silver option. I'm not getting ripped off with all the bells and whistles, but I'm protecting myself from the bare bones. And what you don't understand is that all of those selections are on a continuum that could totally change. You could make the silver option, the bronze option, or the gold option, or something, you know, four steps from either one of those. So the range of options you're offered impacts your choice so incredibly, and yet we never stop to think
Mm-mm.
of it in an objective way. We just sort of look at the couple that we're offered and go, ah, I can now infer what I think is the smart choice for myself.
There's just so many ramifications for what you're saying, and I'm thinking of healthcare just as an example, because to your point, coming from a different school system, and I'll just give this as a personal example, where we had 10 plans to choose from to the state of North Carolina, where everyone is on the same state plan, it was very difficult to deal with that. And I have a feeling, and we'll take a break, but I do want to talk about this, there's probably an emotional reaction when you have choices and then suddenly you don't.
Yes, that's very impactful.
We are going to take a break. You are listening to The Art of Potential Show with Kristen Heemstra.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is Kristen Heemstra, and I am talking with Dr. Stacy Wood. So we're talking about change in choices, and one of the topics we just talked about was how the amount of choices impacts your thinking.
Yes, and this is really critical right now because you can think about different ways in which consumers are offered lots of choices or not offered lots of choices. We can think of debates within healthcare. We can think of changes within the Medicare system, all kinds of stuff that's related to health at this moment relates to the number of options that we have, but it also relates to our retirement choices and even just the chocolate that we might buy when we go into, you know, the little Godiva store and see an array of 40 different bonbons to choose from. Choice impacts us and in ways that aren't always let's say intuitive.
But are they emotional?
In some ways, yes. So one of the things that that's a big topic in choice right now is what's known as choice overload. So researchers like Barry Schwartz and Sheena Iyengar have studied how consumers aren't great when they're given a lot of choices. That choices.
So what does it mean if consumers aren't great? Like they'll just be like, oh, I'm overwhelmed. I'm not going to buy anything.
There are two things. Either one, they make a suboptimal choice. So if you could sort of objectively look at the criteria they want, they don't choose the best option.
Okay.
Or even worse, in some cases, they don't choose any option. So a place where not choosing any option is really terrible is something like retirement savings.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are offered a retirement package and you get a choice of funds and there are 20 funds and that overwhelms you
and you choose nothing,
that's a terrible decision.
Right.
If you're offered a choice of three and you can easily make a choice,
mm-hmm.
that's a good thing. But an economist would say giving people 20 choices is always better than giving people 3 choices, because everyone has different individual benefits that they desire, different right. attributes that are important to them. And so the more choice you give people, the more they'll be able to optimize their particular individual choice. So it's this constant tension between how do you give people enough choices so that they can maximize their individual benefit, but not so many choices that they don't choose at all. And the interesting thing is that there was a lot of research on this choice overload and how so many consumers opted out whenever they were given big choices, that there were some people who took this and said, well, then that means that we shouldn't offer consumers any choices at all. It's paternalistic, but it's kind of a good thing to say, there's one, you've got it.
Be happy.
Be happy.
And don't complain.
Right. But interestingly, I've done some research with health economists, including Melaine McInnes, who's at the University of South Carolina, on looking at this in a context of Medicare Part D. And what we found, and we were studying consumers who a lot of people consider to be vulnerable decision makers. Yeah. We were studying elderly decision makers. In our study, the mean age in our study was, I think, 80 or 82. I mean, these were not college students doing this study. But when we looked at these decision makers, we offered them 2 different choice sets, similar to what the decisions they would have to make between plans and Medicare Part D. And we either offered them 6 choices to look at or 24 choices to look at. And you can imagine that the packet of information for the 24 choice condition was daunting. Now, we gave people 2 weeks to think about it.
So you gave them 2 weeks to think about what if they wanted to look at 6 options or 24 options.
Well, it was a nice study because we had them come in and look at all options at time 1 when they first came in, and they could make a choice right then. Or they could defer their choice and say, I don't feel comfortable yet making this choice. I want to come back in 2 weeks. Everyone came back in 2 weeks, but they could say, I want to come back and make my choice at the 2-week marker. And then even at the 2-week marker, they could say, I don't know. I want to delay this, or I don't want to choose at all. So we could kind of capture some of those non-choices. They could make the choice early. They could make the choice late. They could get help. We tried to make it as realistic as possible. But the other thing we made really realistic, and this is always fun when you're doing research that needs funding, we made the monetary incentives of their choices realistic too. So if they chose the best plan for them and their medications, they got money. And if they chose a plan that was suboptimal, they got less money. And if they chose no plan, they got no money.
Okay, so you have to, I mean, you're forcing, well, you're not forcing a choice, but you're highly encouraging a choice.
Mm-hmm. But it's the same as the real world, right? When people don't make choices and leave money on the table, when there are savings plans that they qualify for but don't enroll in. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we look at this all the time where people don't enroll in things that are good for them, and we go, what?
Right.
They left money on the table. So we were looking at one of these situations where there's money on the table. And what we found is that contrary to the choice overload research that showed that people, as soon as you increase the choice beyond 6, people sort of just kind of fell apart, we found that our elderly decision makers did not show any diminution in the quality of their choices. They chose well, even when they had 24 options to cull through.
Yeah.
And so what we think this means is that the more there's a monetary incentive, the more there's money on the table, the more people will work through their choices. However, we do think that there is still a point where for some decisions, the number of choices really does cause delay and deferral and non-choice in a lot of cases. So I'm not arguing that we give everyone unlimited choices, but it was interesting to see that we do have some evidence that even with some people might call a vulnerable consumer group, there was strong decision-making even in the midst of what I would say 24 choices in this case was a strong number of choices.
Yes, it was.
But we did not study 100 choices.
Right.
And so there's got to be a limit there somewhere.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because you're dealing with an age group who at the time in their lives may also have more energy and time to invest in the choices. And I would think that would be kind of an interesting part too, because when you're at a different point in your life, sometimes it's easier just to pay someone to make the choice for you because you just don't have the time to invest it. And therefore, it's easier to just, you know, give it to someone else mm-hmm. to do.
Yeah, that actually plays into another project that that I've worked on in terms of pharmaceutical products and looking at how people learn about using products. And this is a little bit of a leap, but I think it speaks very much to what you're talking about, is that we have perceptions of who are vulnerable consumer groups, mm-hmm. and children and the elderly definitely top those.
Right.
But those consumers are often novice consumers. And so I did some research with John Lynch at the University of Colorado, where we looked at and found, again, counterintuitively, that experts in a certain category were worse at learning new information than novices.
I shouldn't laugh so hard. No.
I know. But we can all think of experts in our life who think they know and who don't know. And what we found is that what's the matter is that experts are complacent. Experts think they know, and when the world changes, when they get new information, they don't really update well. They don't change.
Well, their paradigm doesn't shift.
That's right. And for novices, they don't have that sort of cluttered slate. They have a blank slate, and oftentimes they have more motivation. Like you were saying, that you know there are people at certain points in your life where you're a little bit more motivated to learn about things, either because you're a high school student or a college student who's doing it for the first time on your own and you got to really pay attention, or you're a senior citizen who is not working and who has a little bit more free time to really pay attention. But a lot of people in those middle ages, we found in with doctors that doctors instruct what people that they perceive to be highly vulnerable people, the elderly and younger patients, much more than they do sort of middle-aged adults.
Okay.
But they don't know they do it. So they think that they're giving everyone the same instructions. Yeah. But what happens—
I'm sure we're all guilty of that.
Oh, yeah. No, of course we are. We actually came up with the idea for the study as I was waiting in line at the pharmacy as a college professor. I'm using the university pharmacy, standing in line with all the college students. I get up to the front of the line. The pharmacist has been spending 5 minutes with every student, telling them, giving them instructions. I get up there. It's a medicine I've never had before. They hand me my bag, they swipe my credit card, and I'm done.
Goodbye.
Yeah, and I think they thought, well, you can read the instructions. But again, experts, people who perceive themselves as not vulnerable, a little complacent, I'm actually the really dangerous consumer or patient in that case. And so this is kind of a bad thing in medicine, right, that we under— serve a group that's sort of not perceived to be vulnerable, when in actuality they are actually more vulnerable because of this overconfidence.
Yes.
So it's like everybody's overconfident, the person, the teacher, and the student, and that's a bad scenario.
Yeah, especially with medicine.
Yes.
All right. Well, you are listening to the Art of Potential show. This is Kristen Heemstra.
You're listening to The Art of Potential on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back. This is The Art of Potential show, and I'm Kristen Heemstra. I'm talking with Dr. Stacy Wood, and we're talking about how we, being consumers, we are having people study every behavior. And actually, I do want to ask about that. So how many analytic points are going out about every community's behavioral spending?
In terms of what companies are looking at?
Yes.
You are definitely monitored. Your spending is definitely monitored. And companies care a lot.
I've recently read this article about what Target, not only do they get the information that I give them when I go through and buy their products, but they're also buying lists of what magazines I'm getting and, all these kinds of things. So I assume this is common practice?
This is common practice. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to build what they would call a narrative of who you are. Your marketers often call this segmentation, where they're trying to come up with blocks of consumers who act similarly, and that you can correlate that with certain interests, certain behaviors, certain likings, dislikings, what you drive, what you spend on different kinds of soap, anything that gives them a sense of being able to predict what you'll buy next.
So, and I assume this is going on the internet too, because if I go, it's interesting, I've seen it recently, where if I go to, say, Amazon or Overstock and I look at a particular item and then go to a totally different website, all of a sudden advertisements for what I was just looking at start popping up.
It's true. In fact, the internet gives us so many links to what people are doing, gives you so many trails. I sometimes wonder if people realize how much computers and the internet capture the trails of where you go.
Why don't you tell me so I can be embarrassed about how much they know? I mean,
it's I think that, you know, politicians and people who are doing bad things, you know, oftentimes find to their detriment how exactly pervasive these trails are. You can be monitored even after the fact. So this is something that companies do, and it's more or less accurate. I find, you know, like Google and Amazon and the efforts that they put in are highly motivated and incentivized by the companies they work with. And but it's still not a perfect science. Just the other day, I was on Amazon looking for baby stuff, and I got a little recommendation for ammo. I thought, you are approaching an academic who lives in Chapel Hill, and ammo was your best guess. I wondered, where have I been recently that would
suggest I wanted gun ammunition for some. Yes, apparently it's not a perfect science.
That's right.
Which is why I'm always shocked when I see all these single guys, like, you know, they have all these singles things, and I'm like, what gave you the idea that A, I'm single, B, I would, anyway. It's very interesting. One of the most interesting things to me being a consumer has to do with the prices that we pay for the things that we get and how we view those. And you were saying earlier in a conversation we had, there's a term for this.
Yes, it's the price quality heuristic. And it's one of the most robust, powerful, hard to shed decision heuristics that impact us as consumers. And the idea is that we infer quality from price because quality is ambiguous. I mean, how clean is the water, the bottled water you're drinking? How good is the sweater that you buy? How fuel efficient is the car that you drive? I mean, even things that seem like you can kind of document their performance are really rather ambiguous. You know, if you go to a restaurant, is the soup really good or do you just think it's good? It's hard. And so what we do is we as consumers say, well, I know that expensive things seem like good things. So the more I pay for something, the more I perceive that it's high quality. And if I have to look at an array of things and guess which one is going to last longer or be better quality, I am so geared to saying the more expensive thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I tell my students that there are actually very few industries where there is a significant linear correlation between price and quality, they just don't believe me.
Yeah, no.
You know, they think that, you know, a $6 bottle of wine cannot taste better than a $50 bottle of wine, and a pair of shoes that cost $1,000 must you know, be better and last longer than a pair of shoes you bought for $20. And this just isn't the case. You know, we can look at all kinds of product categories. And while there are some high-priced products that are good quality and some low-priced products that are poor quality, there's just not that linear significant relationship. You can find low-priced, high-quality goods and high-priced, poor quality goods. It just happens. And so this is really important because, again, as consumers, if we can truly get that into our heads, we can benefit for a lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can justify buying cheaper goods without the guilt of, yes, but what if this isn't quite as good?
Right.
Now, it requires, you know, doing your research and finding out what people recommend or, you know, finding out if there are objective markers of quality that you can look for. But one of I do some neuroscience research, meaning I look at consumption and brain scans, looking for brain activity. And this has been a lot of fun. And there's some research that I love. It's not research that I did, but a great researcher named Hilke Plassmann did, where she looked at brain scans of people while they drank sips of wine.
Ooh.
Yes, I know. Fun.
And so she got volunteers for that one.
it was an easy study to recruit for. So people are laying in the MRI scanner, having their brain scanned while they've got this tube in their mouth that's delivering these little sips of wine, and they're being shown information about the wine while they're drinking it. And so they were given a sip of wine that I think was like a $9 bottle of wine, and then another sip of wine from a bottle that they were told was $90. And so, you know, if you ask people explicitly which wine should taste better, they would say
$90
bottle.
Yeah,
of course.
I would.
Yeah. But you would also think that if they actually tasted the wine and there was no actual difference in quality, we'd be able to taste it, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't like where this is going, yeah, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, so we think we'd be able to taste if there wasn't a significant quality difference. And even if we thought there was a quality difference, like we were just sort of, we just wanted to say there was a quality difference, but we didn't actually taste it, we wouldn't think that our brains were fooled. And so what Plassman and her colleagues found is that that not only did people self-report that the $90 bottle of wine tasted better, but their brains actually recorded more neural responses in the areas that relate to pleasure and desirability. So the brain actually experienced it as tasting better, experienced it as more pleasurable.
Interesting.
What the subjects did not know is that they were getting a sip of the same wine, that the $9 bottle and the $90 bottle were literally the same wine.
Wow.
So there was no quality difference.
Right. None at all.
None at all.
It reminds me of a long time ago when Coke redid their label. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a different thing, but
yeah, but it goes to show how powerful this is. And so, again, if you can find different markers of quality that you trust, you can give up price as a marker of quality and save yourself a lot of money over the course of a lifetime. And you can trick yourself. So, if you buy a bunch of discount bottles of wine that have been rated pretty well by, you know, some magazine or something like that, but they were cheap, I would say have a good friend go through, peel off all the little labels that say $6.99,
right,
and replace them with little labels that say $36.99,
right,
and you will have a fun time drinking your way through a wine cellar that seems really, really good.
You got at a fraction of the cost.
Right.
Oh, how funny. Well, it is interesting that we can lead our brains in this way, or it's scary that companies can lead our brains in this way. And I was just wondering, as you were talking about that, I wondered if the descriptions of the wines were different. And, you know, did the $90 bottle of wine just sound more delicious than the $9 bottle of wine? Was there anything at all besides just the price marker?
In the study, it was just the price marker.
How interesting.
Yep.
All right. Well, that is definitely food for thought for all of us. I would like to thank everyone for listening to the Art of Potential show. Please feel free to go to our website on artofpotential.com and follow us on Twitter at Art of Potential. Thank you, Dr. Wood, for joining us. You have been a pleasure to talk to.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.